From banners and magnetic signs to t-shirts, decals, and business cards, New Vision Graphics has been leading the industry in the development and production of top-quality products and quality banners for over 13 years. Get durable, full-color banners featuring your logo in multiple sizes with the most reliable service. Winning teams are using banners from New Vision Graphics right now, and you can too. And you can market your company, church, or organization with shirts, caps, beverage coolies, and more, all with your logo and team information, printed with state-of-the-art equipment and the best service in the business. Call the hotline at New Vision Graphics for quotes and more information. 800-HOT-4479. That's 800-HOT-4479. Or visit the website, www.newvisiongraphics.cc. www.newvisiongraphics.cc. Welcome to the new world, New Vision Graphics.
This is Ray Lampe, Dr. Barbecue, and my prescription is for you to listen to the Barbecue For You show.
Coming up next on the Barbecue For You show.
Do you inject pork or brisket?
I do now. To be right honest with you, I didn't used to. Barbecue has changed. I mean, it's an evolution. You can't do today what I can't do what I used to do back in the late 90s.
Welcome to the Barbecue For You show, the show where we talk about all things important to the world of barbecue. From big name interviews to advice on cooking briskets and ribs, you'll find it right here on the Barbecue For You show. If you're interested in learning more about barbecue, log on to our website at www.bbq-4-u.com. Get connected to the best forum on the internet. And now, here's your program host, Greg Rimpey.
Thank you, Jim Morgan, and welcome everybody to another edition of the Barbecue For You show. Wherever you are across this great country of ours, certainly appreciate you taking time out to join us. My guest tonight has been nationally recognized on the national barbecue circuit. He's won numerous awards to include the 1998 Jack Daniel's Invitational Reserve Grand Champion, the 1999 KCBS Overall Fourth Place Team, and the 2000 World Barbecue International Contest Grand Champion Ribs Perfect Score for the Best Ribs in the World. On top of that, he is also a pit manufacturer, and in March of 2005, he partnered with the Oklahoma-based Cook Shack Incorporated to introduce his Fast Eddie's brand of smokers. On top of all that, he is also a professional firefighter. I am, of course, talking about Ed Morin, or perhaps as some of you know him, Fast Eddie, and he joins me right now. Eddie, welcome to the Barbecue For You show.
Well, thank you. Look forward to talking barbecue with you.
Eddie, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
47 years of age. I started cooking barbecue competitions in 1986. I'm a welder fabricator by trade, and I made a living as a firefighter for Kansas City, Missouri.
You did start competing in 86. How many events do you think you've competed in over the years?
You know, in 86 when I started, it was only two or three a year. And then it went to three or four. And then in 1990s when I decided to really get aggressive about cooking barbecue. I was racing cars back in that time. I raced off-road race cars, and then I owned a midget myself for a couple of years. And so I was pretty heavily involved in motorsports. And, of course, I had friends who had sprint cars and late models, and I spent a lot of time at the racetracks. So, yeah, motorsport's been a big passion of mine for many, many years. But barbecue, everybody in the family loved the barbecue thing, and everybody hated the race. And so I just changed and headed a different direction.
Was there a big family tie to barbecue, or is it just because from the area that you're around that it's popular and that's something you wanted to get into?
I guess it was just because it was a fun thing. It really started out... I'm kind of similar to like a lot of the pit manufacturers. You know, I had a fellow come to, my dad had a little welding shop, and I was working for him part-time, and a guy wanted this smoker built, and he was a buddy of somebody lived next door to him a couple doors up the street, and his name was Neil Van Hoosier. And anyway, he come down and told me about what he wanted, and I said, well, yeah, we can put this together for you, and built him this smoker out of a 300-gallon tank, and offset firebox thing, and I went and watched him break it in. His idea of breaking it in was putting 45 slabs of ribs in it. And I thought, man, this guy's nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and never had this thing cooking before, and immediately just start filling it up with ribs. And I went and seen, and he had all these buddies hanging around, and of course they were having a good time, you know, while they were cooking. Next thing was and I'd see him quite often, and he said, well, why don't you come on down to the American Royal Barbecue with me? I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, it's this barbecue cooking competition, and I do some of these, and I said, okay. So it was 1986. I went down to the American Royal with him at the cook-off down there, and I said, wow, this is – back in those days, if you had a smoker that had wheels on it where you could tow it, you were a big – you were somebody. You were really somebody.
Right.
And I thought, man, this is – and it was fun, you know, something different. Of course, this is November. I think it was like the first week of November then. And it was actually terribly cold. So I went back and I said, you know, I can build me something better than that. And I started gathering up parts and pieces. And then I built myself one. We got to talking more and more. So we started cook together in these cooking competitions. And we made a team name called Dudes Barbecue, because we all sat around drinking and they called each other, hey, dude, you know. So
right.
So we were Dudes Barbecue, and that went on till about 1990, and I wanted to get a lot more serious about it, so we kind of parted ways, and I just kind of went head over heels into this thing. Put the race cars up. I said I was going to figure this barbecue thing out and what it was going to take to become a winner. You know, you're just watching the Paul Kirks and those guys who, for several years, they were the ones going up there getting the awards. And I said, there's got to be something to this that you can figure it out. And that's when I went to start figuring it out. And the building of becoming a pit manufacturer was very secondary. I seen in 1990, that's when I seen the Traeger pellet grill. I said, you know, there's something to this. And I started cooking with those. And then I made my own version of what I think a smoker oven should be using that system. And that was about 93, 94 back in then. And I cooked on that upwards. And in 97, my dad was slowing down and didn't want to do quite as much. And I was on the fire department at the time, and I was just working with him part-time. And I said, you know, I need my own building and start having my own shop and start doing my own thing. And I was custom fabricating, doing all kinds of metal work for different companies and folks. But I was cooking barbecue. Back then, I was doing anywhere between 15 to 18, 20 events a year. And I would fly anywhere to go cook. I didn't care what I was cooking on, neither. If I could get a cooker borrowed, I'd cook on it. It didn't make any difference to me. I was, you know, partial to the pellet cooker, obviously. But flying around and going to these competitions, I started chasing money. And cook-offs that had, you know, a decent pay to it, that's the ones I tried to get myself to. And I was fortunate enough to keep it in the black, even with all the travel costs and things. I was able to win enough money. And, you know, grand championships came here and there, some reserve grands, you'd win some categories. My deal was I was always looking at the bottom line. Could I keep the dollars in the black
right
for what I was doing? And I could. So it got better. I was able to start towing and driving more, taking my own equipment with me, and I got better at it. And then what happened in 1998, I had contracts, this fabrication work, and you would get them and then you would lose them. And I was getting frustrated with that, and people were starting to hammer on me about wanting this cooker like I had. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to go ahead and try to start selling these things. But I made a real decision that when I do, it's no longer about me anymore and my success. It's about the success of my customer. And whatever I can do to make them successful, they need the information to be able to go out and win those awards and things. And so that's what I did. And it also helped build the reputation with the equipment too. So that was really kind of how it started and got going in 98. I was just doing a few here and there. By the time 2000 came around, I was having to start have parts and pieces of it fabricated out, because me and another fireman who was my helper and another part-timer here or there I'd hire in, we couldn't keep up. I got rid of doing other custom work, and then I strictly did barbecues. So since about 2000 on, I've done nothing in my shop but barbecue. I knew in order to make this thing really go anywhere and do something, I was going to have to either invest a whole lot of money and really get in the UL and the NSF, and I really wanted to be in that commercial equipment world. One of the things I did with my dad in his welding business was we would repair pits here in Kansas City, and ones we worked on a lot was J&R Oilers that are built down in Texas. They were a real popular oven here in Kansas City. Used to be a Bodie's Barbecue, had six of them. There was probably about a dozen of them here in town. And we did the repair work on those things. So I really got a good, solid look at what, and working inside and out of these daggone things, and learned a lot about them. Plus, already with the background we had in, you know, the barbecue industry and all, and I just kind of started putting the two together. And I really got a passion for the commercial equipment world. And I knew to make that work, I was really going to have to hook up with somebody. And long story short, I had a friend that knew the CEO of Cook Shack. He made a phone call and see if he'd be interested in taking a look at my product. And I'd seen those guys through the years at the shows. I'd been in and out of some of the barbecue trade shows and all, and dabbled in it here and there. I just didn't have the money to really hit it on a big level. But and of course, they kind of knew me. And I took a cooker with me down to Ponca City, Oklahoma, talked with them. They decided that they'd start manufacturing for me. That was in 2002. And then in 2003, they said, yeah, let's do more than this, and let's hook up and get together on this deal. That's what we did, and it's been a marriage made in heaven. It's just been a great thing, and I can't say enough about the company I'm involved with now.
You've amassed, I mean, I was on the Cook Shack website, and it's got a little portion of items and contests, awards, and all that stuff that you've won over the years, and it's kind of stopped at 2000 at this point. But I mean, you've been reserve grand champion at the Jack. You've won, you know, a number of individual segment awards. Is there one that stands out in your mind as a favorite?
Gosh, I'm kind of looking back here, and they're all sitting around my office. I would probably say so many of these things were won by myself. Okay, I traveled a lot by myself on the road because the family couldn't go with me. One of the ones that really stick out in my mind was the 1998 World Pork Expo, because I had my wife and son with me there when I won that grand championship up there. And that was probably one of the favorite ones that I have, because it was so much fun having the family with me. I think that was probably one of the only or one of the few events that all I have is the one son. And to have, you know, the family there when I win, it was something special.
Do you inject pork or brisket?
I do now. To be right honest with you, I didn't used to. Barbecue has changed. I mean, it's an evolution. You can't do today what I can't do what I used to do back in the late 90s. It doesn't work the same anymore. The flavor profiles have gotten more sophisticated. There's been better products on the market to use. I do inject pork. It was 1995, I won the pork shoulder category at World Pork Expo. It was right when KCBS changed over, I think it's 95, when changed over from any cut of pork to pork shoulder. And the flavor that pork had back in it that day, they weren't breeding pork nearly as lean as they are today. So it had a lot of more natural flavor. If you cook a Berkshire butt or something like that today, that's more the flavor that we used to get back in the early to mid-90s. But leaning this pork up so much, you almost have to inject it in order to get the flavor to it. And you're having to use like a brine, like a salt brine. You got to get that salt down there. Salt always brings out the flavor and everything. That's why we use it. And it just helps really bring out that flavor in pork on the palate. And, of course, the additional things, you know, a little sugar, a little Worcestershire, Maybe put a little honey or you know, some seasonings, whatever you want to add that additional flavor. But the big deal is about getting that saltwater solution down in that pork is what makes a big difference.
Do you think the evolution is bad, or is it just part of things changing and growing into the future?
It's just part of things changing. You know, when I teach a class, I only do it once a year. I try only do it once a year. They're pressuring me to do it more. The little things that you do is what makes the difference between winners and losers. It's doing all the little things right and doing those every time that makes a difference. It's just like, you know, injecting your pork and having that same recipe or working on that recipe and not variating from what works, you know, tweaking a little here or there. I mean, purchasing. I'm a big believer, you know, it amazes me how many customers that I have that are really good cooks. And it amazes me. I'll get in a conversation with them and talking about cooking pork that's been frozen or not. And they'll say, oh, I don't care. It doesn't make any difference to me. And my gosh, I just about fall over because I really see a big difference in the texture of the product of cooking something that's fresh compared to something that's frozen. And I can't get the consistency and how I want it to turn out, but these people that doesn't bother them or they're not looking beyond that, it just amazes me. I mean, these guys are pretty good cooks. I mean, they're not everyday winners every time they pull up, and I'm trying to make them better, you know, and I'm trying to get them to understand you ought to start taking a look at those finer points and where are you making some mistakes, you know.
One of the burning questions on any barbecue forum that you would go on to is how to cook brisket. So in your expert opinion, is it better to cook brisket fat side up or fat side down?
It depends on your cooker, okay, is what I would say. I don't know why people are going to get this is going to sound like a real silly answer, but if your brisket's starting to get crusty on one side, you don't want the side that your fat's not on, okay? You don't want that to start getting a hard crust to it. If it is, then turn it over, because it's getting too much heat impinging on it is what it's doing, and you can't have a crusty side to that to try to get the knife down through when you're cutting it. Now, if you're foiling it, you know, at some point, that'll soften it back up, mm-hmm. obviously. But it depends really on how your cooker works. Like, on my rotisseries, I can cook those with fat side up. But on the FEC 100, I have everybody cook them fat side down, because the heat's coming directly from the bottom of the cooker up, and you use that fat as a barrier against the heat's what you do.
What advice would you give somebody looking to get into competitions?
I'll tell you, first thing to do is go and take some cooking classes from some of these guys. I would go down the list and look at who's been out there recently and been winning stuff. Those are the guys, that's where I'd start going. Okay, and don't just do one. I would say maybe three. If I was going to get in this from a dead blank start, I would probably want to take three different classes is what I would do. Do a lot of research on the internet, and then of course get to cooking a lot too. One of the things I did that helped me tremendously, and I took advantage of that being a firefighter, that I'd cook a lot and practice all the time at work. And I had those guys at work were my judges, and I would do two or three different recipes on some. If we were going to have ribs, they got usually two or three different recipes of ribs every time. Chicken, I mean, they would get two or three different types of chicken every time. And I'd always do what they liked or what I liked too, you know. And then I would always do one or two others that I was thinking about trying. The last thing you want to do is use a cook-off as an experiment. You want to know going into that what your plan's going to be. It costs way too much money to go to a daggone cook-off to experiment. I mean, it used to, back in the mid to late 90s, a typical cook-off for me was anywhere between $600-$800. I mean, for a guy that didn't even make that a week, that's a lot of money.
Right.
Okay. Today, for me to go do a cook-off, it's running anywhere between $1,000 and $1,100 to go to it. So, and with all the travel expenses and everything, and that's a lot of money to go throw away on trying something. You want to know, I mean, I really fully expect to get my way paid when I go to an event. I'm disappointed if I don't, but my expectations are to win enough money to cover my cost. And that's what that's the kind of attitude you ought to be able to have when you really put the rubber to the road.
Previously, you had mentioned that you had hooked up with Cook Shack Incorporated to help you out with manufacturing of the cookers that you came up with, the FE line.
Mm-hmm.
Ed, tell us about the FE line of cookers, features, and what kind of a fuel source it uses, etc.
Well, the FE cookers it's a pellet cooker, and we use a feed system similar to what the Traeger pellet grill uses. And we actually have an agreement with them to use that system. So we're not circumventing their patent. We actually pay them a royalty on every product sold.
Mm-hmm.
And there you'll see a Traeger sticker or their logo on every one of our products also. But it burns wood pellets. And why I'm so big on wood pellets is because a pellet's a 6-7% moisture content in it, and it's all heartwood. You don't have any bark. Okay, and the pellet burning appliance is under forced air draft that makes these things, that burns these pellets. And of course, it's computer controlled how it feeds, and it uses an auger that feeds the pellets into a fire pot where they burn. You don't have to concern yourself with temperature. You don't have to concern yourself with the quality of fuel that you're burning. You don't have to concern yourself. It even has, with our new controls, you can even set how long you want it to cook at what temperature rate, and then drop into a holding pattern. And we can actually hold down around 140 degrees on wood. So we've learned how to control that air and fuel mixture to be able to operate at different temperatures. We're also, one of the things we're able to do is we're able to get this thing really extremely close on temperature at where it sets. We're 4 or 5 degrees over set point to 4 or 5 degrees under set point. And it'll cycle back and forth through that within about a 3 to 4 minute period. So it really, when you graph it out, it's almost just dead straight on all the time. Another nice thing about the pellet cookers, you can open and close and get in and out of it, and your recovery comes back almost instantaneously. You don't have to worry about losing cooking time if you like to mop and baste or get in and out of your pits. It really makes a huge difference on the commercial side of stuff when you start looking at what this does for you commercially. You can put product on and off the pellet cooker all day long. You can mix and match products at different time ratios and all, and you're always going to get the same flavor. Who we compete against are multi-fuel cookers, which will be gas and logs both. When you set your logs, your wood will burn usually for about 4 or 5 hours, and then you're basically heating the oven with gas. Well, let's say you're running a load of butts or briskets, and you're in halfway through the cooking process, and you want to put on some ribs. You shouldn't do that because you won't. Number one, you'll have to reset your flavor because your flavor is already burned up. So if you reset your flavor and you mix those two products, then you're going to put too much smoke on your briskets or butts that you're running, and when you got to put flavor on your ribs. Now, with my product, it doesn't matter because that's what is burning anyway. So it takes that out of the equation. Pellets burn up to about anywhere between 1% to 3% ash content, depending on the brand of pellet that you're burning. Some pellets are a little bit better quality than others. I mean, you can run the thing 24/7 around the clock on our big commercial pits, and you'd only have to take the ash out of it one time a week, compared to every time you set the logs on our competitors who are the multi-fuel cookers. You're supposed to drag the ash out of it every time you put more logs on it. Usually those facilities that do that, you'll always go and see the dumpsters have caught fire, and they'll burn the lids off of them and the paint off of them. And that's one of the things. I can reach down in the pellet cooker while it's burning and pick up the ash right underneath the burner and pick it up in my hand and rub it. I do it when we do some trade show events that we're able to be burning at, I'll do that. It just freaks people out.
Yeah.
I see this is how safe it is. And this is how complete we burn up the fuel. This is like a sand. and it just amazes them. And then, of course, getting pellets, a lot of places you can't get wood around the country very well. Especially Vegas and Salt Lake City and places like that, hardwoods are really hard to come by. And you can get those pellets shipped anywhere to you by regular truck. And pellets are just, I mean, you'll never, ever, ever get an over-smoked flavor with a wood pellet. That's another nice thing about it. You can't mess it up. Even if you try, you can't mess it up.
What's the science behind that exactly?
Well, it's because very low moisture content. I mean, if you, a cured wood, if you've taken firewood and set it out there and covered it and let it set for about a year, you'll get it down to that 6 to 7% moisture content is what it'll get down to. And if you knock the bark off of it and then go to burn it, that's really what you got. And we're using the ground sawdust, and they actually, when they take the sawdust and they go to make the pellets, they actually inject steam into the sawdust, and they try to get it up to about a 15 to 16% moisture content when it goes into the rolling mill. And it extrudes the sawdust through these little holes, and then there's knives on the outside of it that cuts them off, and it compacts this sawdust together, and it's a natural lignans in the wood that makes its own binder is what it does. And it's 100% pure wood is what it is.
Is there a particular supplier of wood pellets that you would recommend commercial applications or people that have them in their homes to use?
Well, there's definitely a big difference between heating pellets and barbecue pellets. Okay. And a lot of these folks they'll see pellets in their Lowe's, or Walmart will carry them in certain areas during the winter time, and those are heating pellets
for
and
wood stoves or something like that.
For wood stoves, pellet stoves, right. Yeah. And all the manufacturers will have their own recipe that they make, and they're one of the common things that they'll use is they'll mix a little bit of softwood in there with it. When they're running 100% hardwood on their mills. It's pretty hard on those mills when they're pounding that hardwood through there. I know that my guy who makes my pellets for me, it's tough on his mill when he goes making the barbecue pellets. And also for a lube on the mill, we use a cooking oil when they go to running the barbecue pellet. And it's the pellets, the raw material is kept complete and away from the other materials when they get ready to do it, and they run the whole line empty, and so we make sure we don't have anything else other than 100% hardwood, and we don't have no petroleum products in there.
There's two other pit, you would call them multi-fuel pits, that I won't mention by name, but there's two of them that jump right to my mind. Are there any big chain restaurants or commercial applications that are using your cookers right now?
Yeah, there is, and if anybody wants to know, I wouldn't mind. They can email or they can call us about it. I gotta contact them. One of them's Lawler's Barbecue out of Southern Tennessee. I can mention him, but there's another company, they don't want me to mention their name. They've got about 34, 35 stores. Their MO used to be that they would burn hickory wood down to coals and then shovel coals. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they were wanting to grow this chain, and I got contacted by a fella that said I might ought to give him a call, because they looked at everybody. They looked at Cook Shack, they looked at Southern Pride, they looked at Old Hickory, they looked at everything on the market, and nobody could match their flavor profile. And this guy who contacted me was a pellet guy, and he says, Eddie, I think you might ought to talk to these folks. I think you could help them out. So I talked to him on the phone for about a half an hour, and the guy said, you talk different than anybody else that's been here. And he says, why don't you come and cook for us? So I went and cooked for him. Long story short, on the first try, I hit it about 95% exactly what they were doing. And the second try, after I made an adjustment to what we were doing, I hit it dead on. and the guys could not taste the difference between what they were cooking and what I cooked for them. They couldn't tell the difference. So, and saved them a ton of money, saved them a ton of labor. You can't get them to go back to the old way of what they were doing. Although they'd like people to still think that they're, you know, they're cooking the old traditional, burn the wood down to coals and shoveling those coals, but they got those machines and they do a lot of the commissary type technique where they cook it all in one location and then take it out to their satellite stores. They've got 14 FE750s in one room.
I got to imagine if I'm a restaurant owner too, having a Fast Eddie in my kitchen kind of eliminates some potential health hazards as far as, you know, wood to burn, where I'm going to put the wood. Am I treating the wood to keep rodents and pests out? You know, I mean, that's got to be a pretty big load off of a potential restaurateur's mind, especially, you know, somebody's looking to get into barbecue.
One of the questions I always like to post to the people when they come to a trade show is, has your health department asked you this question? Have you sprayed your wood pile lately? Now, how do you answer that one?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yes. You mean you're feeding what you're burning to the public? That?
I mean, no.
Well, we're going to have to do something about all these pests and rodents that you have.
Right.
Okay, so it's really a no-win-win situation. And that's another thing. You know, they don't like the wood piles stacked up against the buildings at all. Your big chains, for instance, but big chains, what they're doing is they're buying their wood in boxes, and they have it sent to their food warehouses. So it comes out with their food order. Where they have to get that supply from is a fumigated source. Okay, I've seen the cost of logs in a box run as high as $70 a box.
Wow.
And another thing too, if you can't ship wood across from Canada to the United States or into Mexico or into Japan or anything like that without it going through a fumigated source. And those fumigators get just buku tons of money. But the thing about pellets is, see, it's a processed wood product. So you can ship those. And it's going to make a huge difference in barbecue internationally too.
How many different models do you offer in the Fast Eddie line?
Right now we have three. We've got the FEC100, which is extremely popular on the cook-off circuit. And your real big backyard enthusiast buy those. Some caterers, light caterers, will buy them. Then you got the FEC750, which is a 700-pound cooker, rotisserie cooker. And then you've got the FEC500, which is a 500-pound rotisserie cooker. I do have, hopefully within the next 90 days, I've just got done doing the R&D on a 300-pound unit that should be available for market. I'm going to say within 90 days. We've had some pretty successful tests. And it's looking real good, and I think within 90 days we'll have that unit, which will be a 30-inch rack unit from right to left.
Eddie, can you talk about the new controller that the FE line has?
Yeah, it's what we call the IQ4 controller. We used to use a standard controller from Traeger. We've been in development for about a year and a half on this, what we used to call it the IQ3, now we call it the IQ4. And it's the standard controller that Cook Shack uses on all their commercial products. And it's got cook and hold features to it. But the IQ4 also has the capability to be able to cook by probe. So, and then we only be able to do that on the FEC100 on the stationary racks. You can't do it on the rotisserie. But you can put the probe into the jack and then plug it in and stick it into the oven. And put it into like a brisket or a pork butt or a rib roast or any kind of thick piece of meat. And you can set to what temperature you want that piece of meat to get to. So you'd set the cooker temperature at what temp you want to cook at. You'd set your probe temperature at what temperature you want the probe to get to. And then it'll go into the holding pattern. And then you can actually set the hold on the way, all the way down to 140 degrees. Another thing about the hold feature, and you can do this on the rotisserie or the stationary unit is. A lot of the competition cooks are using, when you run at a lower temperature, like down around 180 is real popular with the pellet cookers, you're producing lots of smoke. And they'll do that for a long period of time overnight, and then they'll use the hold for a higher setting instead of a lower setting. So they'll run like 180 for 8 hours, and then they'll set the hold temp at 250, and then it'll kick up to a higher temperature. So when they wake up in the morning, the cooker's running along at a higher temp than where they had set it. And that's getting to be extremely popular. So you have all this, and also another thing too, with the Traeger controller, we were only able to set it at 25-degree increments. Well, 25, the first one, actually, they had a 180, and then it went to 250, and then it went to 25-degree increments. With the new IQ4, you can set it in 2-degree increments. So you can set it 200, 202, 204.
Wow.
You know, it can be done in 2-degree increments, and it's just incredible how close we can get it now.
What did you think about the English team taking the Jack Daniels with a Fast Eddie cooker?
They're a real sharp pair. Rick and Jackie's become real good friends of mine. I've been over to England and worked with them twice now. Those folks are just super, super sharp individuals. They've had a FE 6 or 8 months before the Jack that year, and they'd been cooking at home quite a bit. See, they're also beef producers. They raised limousine cattle. And they showed cattle too, so I mean they were very, very much involved, and also in cooking over there. They sold different products to a lot of pubs. Jackie would make sausages, and she would make bacons and all that kind of stuff. So they also, besides being ranchers, they were also a producer of product. So people don't really realize what their background was. It didn't surprise me one bit how they had done that day. You know, of course, I was there with them, and I got to taste everything they turned in, and it was really, really good. So it didn't surprise me one bit. With all the internet hubbub that went on afterwards, I was terribly disappointed in the American barbecue world over here because I don't think they quite got a fair shake. Everybody wanted to make point they thought I was cooking for them. That was the farthest from the truth, and I felt like it probably, you know, people tried to take away from what they had achieved, and I was very disappointed in the U.S. barbecue world.
You've cooked in different countries. I mean, what's that experience like? Similar to what it is over here in the States, or is it something completely different?
Well, I've never cooked barbecue competition overseas. But I have cooked overseas. I've cooked in Switzerland. I was brought over one time by the Swift Beef Council in 2000 and went to one of their big events and to show them how we cook beef over here, barbecue, slow cook beef. And then, of course, working with Rick and Jackie and cooking at cooking slow cooking barbecue. I mean, people think barbecue over there is grilling. And, of course, they're trying to show people it's slow cooking and bigger cuts of meats and those things. They are literally on fire about it. They just love it when people get a chance to taste it and see and you talk about it. I mean, to tell you, I was at an event where they had all kinds of fancy chefs at it, and it was the Kent Show in there in Kent, which is the south side of England. It would be more like a state fair for us, but it's a county fair for them. Mm-hmm. But it'd be to that size of a very large state fair for us. I mean, probably a couple hundred thousand people come through the thing in 2.5-3 day period. I mean, had lots of well-known, they had a taste of area. And when Jackie, Rick, and I would do our demos there, we filled the seats, and every bit of food that we cooked got ate like crazy.
Yeah,
compared to anybody else there. The people that put on the show was just amazed at the response that the people had towards the American, and they put it on like as American barbecue, and they just went absolutely nuts over it. So it's... I'm telling you, we haven't scratched the surface of this thing at all. Barbecue is going to infect the world, and it hasn't even really done much over here yet. I mean, it's just getting going, guys. I mean, this thing is got a long, long, long way to go.
Ed Morton builds the FE line of smokers for Cook Shack Incorporated. He also still competes on the barbecue competition circuit, and believe he'll be down in Lakeland, Florida here a little bit later this month. Eddie, thanks for taking the time to talk to me this evening about all things barbecue and especially about the FE line of smokers that you have with Cook Shack, and continued success in the future.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for the invite to come on the show.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Fast Eddie for coming on and talking with us tonight. If you are interested in learning more about his Fast Eddie line of cookers through Cook Shack, go ahead and visit the website at www.cookshack.com. That's CookShack.com. And if you'd like to drop Eddie a line, go ahead and email him at FastEddie, that's FastEddy, at CookShack.com. And don't forget, if you're interested in learning more about barbecue, visit our website, www.bbq-4-u.com. Stay tuned for the new Vision Graphics spot on the Backside Jones for the Barbecue For You show. This is your host, Greg Rempe, saying bye.
From banners and magnetic signs to T-shirts, decals, and business cards, New Vision Graphics has been leading the industry in the development and production of top-quality products and quality banners for over 13 years. Get durable, full-color banners featuring your logo in multiple sizes with the most reliable service. Winning teams are using banners from New Vision Graphics right now, and you can too. And you can market your company, church, or organization with shirts, caps, beverage coolies, and more, all with your logo and team information, printed with state-of-the-art equipment and the best service in the business. Call the hotline at New Vision Graphics for quotes and more information. 800-HOT-4479. That's 800-HOT-4479. Or visit the website, www.newvisiongraphics.cc. www.newvisiongraphics.cc. Welcome to the new world, New Vision Graphics.